I would like to begin with three divinations. 3-3-1. Oh, up on the northern plains, over there, they seek seven gazelles. The thieves shall never get them. They are the possessions of the Mu Men goddesses. Next. 4-2-1. The god Hlamilagyum says, the wild animals are there, residing in the highlands. Though they are innocent, everyone tries to kill them. Not killing them upon that site, they escape from near the juniper brush, and they shall never die. You, man, will also live a complete number of years. A good prognosis. And our third and final divination to start off the night. Oh, on the divine mountain, on the northern mountain, the Mu Men, the powerful Nian God Mountain, beautiful spoken words wrapped with gold, the mountain fog, the turquoise mountain. The turquoise mountain with three corners, on it the Mu Men goddesses and the Nian gods reside. This happy place, high and powerful, is beyond any grown harvest, so the Zepo do not make hunting calls. So you might ask yourselves, what are these animals doing here? And that's what we're going to be asking this evening. These excerpts that I've read you are from 3 9th and 10th century old Tibetan dice divination texts. And there is much that is striking in these 1,200-year-old manuscripts and in the traditions that they describe. The obscure language of the omens, which often come from the mouths of gods and are often rendered in verse, expresses an ancient and forgotten tradition of Tibetan poetics from a time before Indian poetic traditions took hold of the poetic imagination of the Tibetan elites. The interpretation of the omens describes a fascinating ritual economy involving fortune and gods and goddesses of place, in which Buddhism is largely absent. Divination's performative setting also involves a dynamic interplay between the written omens and their ritual enunciation by a diviner. The ludic aspect of casting dice also forms an interesting contrast with forms of ritual work, similarly aimed at calling in good fortune. In coming to grips with the cosmologies and the ritual sensibilities of old Tibetan dice divination, what has struck me most is the integral place of the wild and of wild animals in the omens. Equally fascinating are the gender dynamics that dice divination's cosmology assumes. But leaving gender aside for another time, today I will venture some preliminary answers to the question, what is the role of animals in old Tibetan dice divination? And to try to answer a further secondary question that arises from the first, namely, does dice divination have anything to do with hunting? To venture some answers, I think I should first give you a little background on old Tibetan dice divination, and I'll also just introduce some concepts of fortune and what I mean by economies of fortune, and the distinction between the fortune of animals on the one hand and the fortune of human beings on the other. So I'd also like to give a bit of background on mantic practices in Tibet, just a kind of brief overview on fate, freedom, and prognostication in Tibet, as it were. Many of you, having been here last year and having heard the talks of Donatella Rossi and having had her as a colleague, will have heard a bit of this already, and I will keep it short. But some of the key points deserve repetition. And I would begin by saying that oracles, spirit mediums, are found all over the Tibetan cultural area. So on a village level, you have people into whom a god descends, and then they become the mouthpiece for this god. Very often, what's required is a translator or an interpreter. The pronouncements that come from the mouths of these mediums are not intelligible to anyone, and it requires a translator in order for these pronouncements to be understood and then acted upon. What's interesting is that since the 17th century, the mid-17th century, and the rise of the regimes of the Dalai Lamas, this has been codified on a state level, such that there have been four very important state oracles, offices that are passed on from generation to generation, and who give advice to the ruler in times of crisis or whenever advice is needed. So there we have kind of one of the classical models that we tend to think of in terms of divination and kings and advice to rulers. A second point that I'd like to mention before moving on to divination proper is prophecy. Prophecy is a very important genre of Buddhist writing and of Tibetan Buddhist writing, and was introduced into Tibet from India, but also from Khotan in the 7th and the 8th centuries. The method of writing history in the guise of prophecy and of nativizing the Buddhist religion, putting it into your own soil, whether in Khotan or in Tibet, was introduced and remains the model for historical writing in Tibet to this day. So on to divination, or different practices that we might refer to as divination. This is by no means an exhaustive introduction, but I would like to signal a few traditions as being of particular interest for some of you. Divination in Tibetan is often called mo. That's the Tibetan term for divination. And we have practices of scapulomancy, where the shoulder bone or scapula of a sheep is put in the fire, and the cracks that are made upon it are then interpreted. There's also raven or crow divination. This tradition comes from India, and there are ancient Indian manuscripts, such as the Kakajariti, that were translated into Tibetan, but also independent transmissions of this tradition of raven divination. Now, this depends on the sound that the raven makes, on the behavior of the ravens, but it's also codified according to the direction in which a raven is seen and the time of day. So there's the 10 times of day from dawn until dusk, and there's the 9 directions. So if you see a raven in the southwest at dusk, that's going to be a different omen than if you see a raven in the southwest at dawn, for example. And one can look this up in a table, find the relevant omen, and if it's a bad omen, there are methods for counteracting this bad omen. Rosary divination is another very popular form of Tibetan cleromancy, let's say. It's where you have a rosary called a mala in Sanskrit, a tangwa in Tibetan, 108 beads, and people carry this around and they recite their mantras or prayers and count them off on these beads, grabbing this at random and then moving in, usually in fours, until you have between 1 and 4 beads left. You take that number, then you repeat the procedure twice, so you have 3 numbers, and then these are interpreted to give one an omen or a reading on whether one should do this or do that. Coin divination is no longer practiced, as far as I know, in Tibet, but it is found in the Dunhuang manuscripts. It's also found in Chinese Dunhuang manuscripts. It's a method of throwing 12 coins, and there are 13 prognoses, or omens, within a coin divination text. So if one is obverse or heads, then you have a certain prognosis. If 2 is obverse or heads, then you have a different one. If 3, then a different one, and so on, all the way up until you have 12 all up. If you have 12 down, that's a very, very bad prognosis. That's the 13th. And then finally, dice divination, about which I will tell you quite a good deal this evening. So the period with which I am concerned and the dice divination that I'll be speaking about this evening is early Tibet. Early Tibet, at the center of early Tibet, we can say, is the Tibetan Empire, which is roughly the same period as the Tang Dynasty, 608 to 866 approximately. And the most important things to know about early Tibet and about the Tibetan Empire is that the advent of writing dates to the early to mid 7th century. So this is really the dawn of history, the dawn of historical records in Tibet. And the other very important thing to know about this period is that Buddhism was adopted as one of the official religions of Tibet in approximately 779. So from the second half, or the latter part of the 8th century until the end of the empire, and then in the centuries thereafter, you have a cultural sea change whereby Buddhism, first as an official religion and then as a popular religion, effectively transforms the intellectual and cultural life of Tibet. So this was a long and ongoing process. It wasn't just that the king converted in 779 and then voila, Tibet's Buddhist. This rather took a long time and happened on a grassroots level simultaneously. So this brings up an old research question, namely, how do Tibetan economies of fortune and of divination interact with Buddhist concepts of karma and of transmigration? And we've heard previously about Buddhist antipathy or Buddhist ambivalence towards divination, and this is an interesting line of research to follow in this crucial period when Buddhism is making its inroads in Tibet as well. How did Buddhists come to grips with divination as an important Tibetan tradition? Another point to make about this period is that for most Tibetologists and for most people coming to the subject of Tibet and its history and culture, India is in the forefront of one's mind. And indeed, in the latter half of the 8th century and the first part of the 9th century, there was a huge project to translate Buddhist sutras and commentaries from Sanskrit and from Middle Indic languages into Tibetan. It was a massive project of linguistic codification, of translation policies, of royal commissions of sutras, huge court traveling with sutras, and created a new vocabulary full of neologisms and ways to render in Tibetan a language whose cases were quite unwieldy from the perspective of that language. But the period that I'm looking at, this early Tibet that I'm introducing to you, is a far more cosmopolitan Tibet. It's before this Indic preeminence. And you have influences from China that are extremely important in the early period, in the 7th century in particular, where we're looking at record-keeping, annalistic traditions, administration, also astrology and calculation are coming from China. From Khotan, I mentioned the model of Buddhist prophecy as historiography. From India, apart from all of these transmissions of Buddhism and Indic traditions, we have, as I indicated, raven divination. So to begin with a brief overview of our sources, Old Tibetan dice divination is known to us from about a dozen manuscripts recovered from Dunhuang and Turfan, all but one of which are scrolls. These date to the 9th century of the Common Era, though a few may date to the late 8th century, and at least one dates to the 10th century. And these are, of course, the dates of the manuscript artifacts, and not of the traditions they contain, which might be quite a bit older. So Old Tibetan dice divination employs three rectangular four-sided dice, like so. These are very new. These are not 1,200-year-old dice. In fact, my children and I made these out of Play-Doh this weekend, just to give you an idea of the size and the shape, not the texture. Be careful they don't spill on you. They're kind of fragile. Please pass these around. So there you can see, it's not a perfect likeness. They're a bit messy. They didn't come out so well in the oven. So Old Tibetan dice divination employs these three rectangular four-sided dice and casts them to arrive at one of 64 possible combinations. Now, each such combination corresponds to a prognosis in a divination text. And this practice is now all but unknown in Tibetan culture, since it was replaced by divination with the six-sided dice, which remains in use today, and about which I will say nothing more. Though, as you can see, the slide tells you that it's an additive method where you roll three dice, and the smallest number you can get is 3, the largest is 18, and that gives you 16 possible prognoses. So here you can see images of the dice. The one on your left is from Nia, that's in Khotan. This was from one of Oral Stein's expeditions. And this is from Sirkap, just near Tashila in modern Pakistan. This obviously is not one giant die, but the four sides of a single die, just all in one image. In the image on the left, you can see just the edge of the two. You're looking at the three, but you can see a bit of the two. And then notice that you don't have numbers. They're not numerals one and two written. It's circles. And these circles correspond to the prognoses in a dice divination text. So looking through a dice divination text, it's arranged essentially in paragraphs, at the head of which you have these circles that correspond to the roll of three dice. And this makes for easy navigation. And it also makes for a fairly characteristic page setting, we would call it, that is not shared by many other genres of writing, apart from, notably, law. And law also does use the technology of dice. So we have, in terms of the material cultural heritage, as it's been represented in archaeological findings, a shared technology. There's the Bauer manuscript, which was recovered in Kucha. I mentioned the Sanskrit Pashaka Kevali. This is a tradition of rolling according to this technology of 3 4-sided dice and 64 possible combinations. The Pashaka is the 4-sided dice. The Aksha is the 6-sided dice. These are the Sanskrit terms for them. Another tradition that uses this this same technology is the Irkbitik, the Turkic, runic Turkic Irkbitik, which is also recovered from Dunhuang Cave 17. And 4-sided dice have been found in sites such as Sirkap, Karabad Tepe, and Nia. And there on the map you can see, I have a pointer here, yeah, so there's Dunhuang. There you can see the Irkbitik. Again, there's the circles representing the dice throws. Turfan, the Bauer manuscript. Khotan, where dice were found. Karabad Tepe. And Tashila, Sirkap. So before moving on to the ritual of divination and how one goes about consulting a dice diviner, I would like to note briefly the motif of asymmetry expressed by the form of this characteristic dice. A symmetrical 4-sided die is a pyramid, but the asymmetrical 4-sided die is what's called a hyper-rectangle or a cuboid, with 4 equal long sides and 2 equal short sides, where these latter short sides are unusable. I've come across no commentary or praise concerning the shape of the die, nor about any inherent meaning in the presence or the absence of the blank ends of the 4-sided dice. The material asymmetry of the long and the short sides of the dice mirrors other asymmetries at work in dice divination. Tallying up the 64 prognoses in one old Tibetan dice divination manuscript, for example, we find that 36 of the 64 are characterized as good, 13 as bad, and the remaining 15 as mixed, which means that they're good for certain things and bad for others. The fundamental outlook, or the cosmology, of old Tibetan dice divination is therefore asymmetrical in that the array of possible outcomes, though they be arrived at through the randomizing technology of dice, is weighted in favor of a positive prognosis. As we will see, there are other ways in which asymmetry characterizes dice divination, notably as regards the exchange between human divination clients and the natural and supernatural world with which they commune. The ritual procedure for performing this early Tibetan form of dice divination is known to us largely from a verse introduction to the 10th century dice divination codex. In poetic language, the introduction invokes the sun and moon, summer and winter, the four directions, and six types of animals, evidently two of the air, two of the land, and two of the water, where the first of each pair is either young or embryonic. The introduction then invokes seven groups of 1,000 goddesses each, and they're each referred to by the Tibetan term men. Now, I'll be mentioning this term men. It's important that you keep in mind that this is Tibetan. It's not men as in men and women. That can be very confusing otherwise, okay? So these groups are arrayed, these groups of men goddesses, are arrayed in a descending vertical axis that proceeds from the sky down to the snow mountains, the slates, the high meadows, the crags, and then to the lakes. And at the head of the seven groups of goddesses is the great goddess named Nummen Carmel, or the white sky men goddess. The goddesses are offered jewels, and they are given food offerings and libations. Now, goddesses connected with childbirth and with the natural world, called apsaras, are also central to dice divination in India. And in later Tibetan tradition, the goddess Pendenlamo was strongly associated with dice divination. The strength of this goddess is, incidentally, given as the reason why the women of Lhasa are not allowed to play dice games with the men, since it is said that a woman with a goddess behind her will always win. So this is a matter for another talk, however, on gender in Tibetan divination. To return to the opening verses and their invocation of the ritual setting, the verses mention ritual gifts and fees to be offered to the diviner, who's called a modak, who reads out aloud the written omens. It closes by explaining the method for casting the dice, though the verb used is not the causative rolling or casting or throwing, but the resultative non-volitional falling or descending. Namely, it states that the three dice falls, we'll call them, should result in three prognoses. If the result is either three good prognoses or three bad prognoses, then this is non-negotiable. It's either it's good or it's bad. For mixed or middling combinations, it prescribes further methods, such as rolling a fourth time. A dice divination text, as I've mentioned, is divided into 64 paragraphs, each of which is usually headed by a combination of three numbers, showing to which dice fall it pertains. So there at the top of this, we have a 2-4-2, followed by a 2-4-1, and a 2-3-4, and a 2-3-3. An entry for a given dice fall typically includes three elements. The first is an imagistic utterance, usually from the mouth of a deity, and often rendered in verse. And I refer to this here as an omen. And I refer to the entire entry as a prognosis. Following this speech act or omen, the second element is a prose explanation of the applicability of the omen. It may be good for trade, for family, for health, for defeating one's enemies, etc. Finally, the third element simply states, this is a good prognosis, this is a bad prognosis, or this is a mixed prognosis. There is some variation across the texts, and we can say that the omen and the summation are the two essential parts, since the second element, that of detailed explanation or interpretation, is absent in some texts. This second interpretive element in a divination prognosis tells us essentially what dice divination is for. The interpretation of the omen that I read you to begin this talk about the thieves and the hunters stalking the seven gazelles reads as follows. This has fallen on the divination of the men goddess, Gupang Shele. If you have cast it for household fortune and life force fortune, then the fortune of men shall be undiminished, and the fortune of livestock shall be undiminished. The gods protect your happiness and long life. If you undertake some matter, it will be accomplished. If you've cast this for a sick person, she will recover. If you've requested an official post, it will be given. If you've cast it for subsistence fortune, you will have subsistence. If you've cast it for a companionship or marriage, you will meet it. If you go for trade, you will make a profit. If you've cast it for a visitor, he comes near. For whatsoever you've cast it, this divination is extremely good. So in translating this passage into English, I have occluded the fact that it uses a different term for the fortune of humans than for that of livestock. Human fortune is called cha, and livestock fortune is called yang. The differentiation of the two is sometimes clear, but other times they seem to be conflated. In this connection, one can observe that the Tibetan word for livestock, as in so many other languages, doubles as the word for wealth. So it is perhaps unsurprising that an increase in the fortune of one's livestock could also be viewed as an increase in one's own human fortune. In fact, the most common ritual for increasing fortune, which is fairly ubiquitous across the Tibetan cultural area, is the calling in of yang, that is, the calling in of livestock fortune. Observed rituals and written texts that support these yang summoning or yang calling rituals offer some important insights into concepts of wild and domestic, and concerning the place of animals in Tibetan economies of fortune. Typically, yang is called in or summoned or hooked, either into a village as a whole in a communal ritual or into a household in a private ritual. Yang is quasi-substantial, such that people's windows and doors are open during the rite, but closed afterwards, so that this yang does not leak out. As to where this yang comes from, its source is imagined as the dismembered body of a primordial deer caught by a mythical hunter. When calling in the yang, the officiant does so by waving the foreleg of a deer above his head, often while shouting, "Ku, ku." If no suitable deer leg is to be found, a sheep's leg is a common substitute. Many rituals for calling in yang include auto-commentaries that constitute a discourse on the nature of both cha, human fortune, and yang, livestock fortune, and on their respective sources. One 18th century ritual text for calling in yang states that cha signifies descent from sky to earth, and yang signifies the acquisition of nutrition. In this and other texts and performances of such rituals for calling in fortune, it is clear that fortune resides in wild animals and in wild spaces, and that the aim of the ritual is to transfer this fortune to humans and to their livestock. This points to the manner in which Tibetans conceptualize space, particularly vis-a-vis domestic space and wilderness. The relevant terms are yul and ri. Yul is domestic space, characterized by cultivation, by lowland valleys, and by inhabited villages. Ri is wild space, imagined as high, up there. The term also means mountain, and emphasizes how the continuum of wild and tame is conceived of along a vertical axis. The term for wild animals, particularly those animals that are hunted, is ridak, which means belonging to the wild or belonging to the mountain, belonging to the ri. Domestic animals are likewise called yuldak, though the more common term is chuk, meaning livestock. This insight into the nature of fortune as residing in the wild and in wild animals explains, to a large degree, the ubiquity of both within dice divination prognoses. The exact nature of the relationship between humans and animals in this exchange still remains to be determined, and this is where the question of hunting comes in. Another divination. 133. The blue heavens, they are a firm foundation. The white snow mountains are a powerful base. The divine mountain is a great refuge, so the deer and the kyang do not wander to the edges. By the love of the Mu Men goddesses, those belonging to the Men goddesses thrive and increase. This prognosis is not to be doubted. It is excellent. So for those of you who are not familiar with the equus kyang, that is a kyang. It's often called a wild ass. It's related to the onager. Kyang is apparently a term that's used. So when I say kyang, that's what I mean. In this prognosis, and in others, we find wild animals such as deer, gazelles, and kyang, referred to not as ridak, or belonging to the wild, belonging to the mountain, but as mendak, that is, belonging to the men, belonging to the men goddesses. On the face of it, this would suggest a ludic competition between the men goddesses who protect and, in some sense, possess the animals and the wild spaces, and the humans who cast the dice in an attempt to siphon the fortunate essence of these places and of these animals in order to enhance their own human fortune. Unlike the ritual work of rites for calling in or summoning fortune, dice divination involves chance and risk, in that one stands to lose fortune and not just to win it. One particularly bad prognosis states that its recipient will die within the next year if serious ritual countermeasures are not taken. Drawing the parameters of this ludic competition in such a way, one would assume that the men goddesses' loss would be the humans' gain and vice versa within a zero-sum game in which fortune is a limited resource. There are several omens that seem to confirm such an adversarial position in which human hunters try to steal animals or their essence from men goddesses. Typically, these omens use the image of hunting. 1.4.4, the god Shamegankar says, "You, man, with great strength and a fierce brow, it is the prognosis of the enemy youth. Shoot with the sinew made at a young wild animal and take its life. The gods will be pleased, and your wish will come just as you desire, and in the end you will be happy." A good prognosis. Now there's a reversal of this very same prognosis, which is arrived at by a different dice fall, and in that the man does not kill the young wild animal, and his fortune is to be attacked from within by enemies in his own village. A further prognosis reinforces this sense that hunting is either an analogy for dice divination, or that the two are directly related. 2.2.2, the prognosis of wild animals and kyang. If you've cast this for hunting, you won't succeed. It is a prognosis for scattering. If you've cast it for a human, there will be dishonesty and treason. If you've cast it for enemy fortune, you won't defeat the enemy. A bad prognosis. Looking to the second level, interpretive elements of the prognoses, it is clear that hunting is more than just a metaphor for the chance and the risk involved in dice divination and its mediations with the wild and with wild animals. Alongside interpretations of an omen's relevance for family, health, trade, and so forth, a prognosis will sometimes state its relevance for hunting. Examples are, "This omen is bad for hunting," or, "If you go hunting, you will have success." The latter is a good outcome, and it's listed alongside good household fortune, good health fortune, and so forth. From this, it is fair to conclude that hunting, like trade, family, and health, was among the concerns of those who consulted dice diviners. Now, this clear picture, in which success at hunting and killing the deer is a good omen, and where there is evidently a contest with the men goddesses, is seriously problematized by an even larger number of prognoses in which the men goddesses protect not only the wild animals, but humans as well. It is further undermined by prognoses such as the three with which this talk began, in which images of men goddesses protecting animals from the hunts and bedeviling the hunters are invariably read as good omens, such as the case in the following prognosis. 2.4.2. "Oh, the sky men," says, "above the soft meadows, to draw down the deer and the female yak, they go hunting abroad. Seven gazelles near to the water, I appoint them as my livestock. I gather them and put them in a paddock. The paddock walls are encircled by snow mountains. The snow mountain walls are encircled by cliffs. You, man, who are beset by accusations, now you shall be free of them. A good prognosis. If dice divination imagined a strictly adversarial relationship between humans and men goddesses over the fortunate substance of the wild and of wild animals, represented by the analogy of the hunt, then the men goddesses' win would necessarily be the hunter's loss, and by extension, it should be a bad prognosis. But in this and many other omens, exactly the opposite is the case. The men's protection of the animals parallels the human's protection from accusations. There is a similar analogy at work in the image of the hunter sparing the deer when the protecting men goddess is absent. The result is eternal life for the deer and long life for the man. To summarize, hunters were among those who used dice divination, and hunting was a part of daily life in early Tibet. Within the omens' interpretations, success in the hunt is a good outcome. In the omens themselves, there are some good omens that involve hunters killing animals, but more often, the hunters are the villains, and a good omen involves the men goddesses frustrating the hunter's chase and protecting the wild animals. I am not inclined to regard this as a dichotomy or as a contradictory jumble produced, for example, by an inconsistent cosmology or by errors of oral and textual transmission. Rather, I think it is perfectly in keeping with the analogy between dice divination and the hunt. Hunters must adopt the perspective of their quarry in order to better track it and find it, and they are often deeply sympathetic to wild animals that they hunt and kill. Similarly, they often seek to be in harmony with the gods, goddesses, or spirits that protect the animals and their wild spaces. The ambivalence, or rather bivalence, with respect to the omens adopting the perspective of either the hunters or of the quarry, or of either the hunters or of the men goddesses, well expresses the two sides of hunting and of ritual exchange with supernatural beings. To hunt successfully, one must adopt the quarry's perspective, yet one does this for one's own human ends. To worship a god or to deceive a demon, one must also adopt its perspective, the better to please or entice it, again, in the service of human ends. This sense of being drawn in two ways at one time, of identifying simultaneously with the wild target, either of hunting or of divination, while remaining the human hunter or the human divination client, also relates to the role of fortune in the construction of Tibetan personhood. Another commentarial passage in a Yang Kalig ritual text states that humans without cha, that's human fortune, would be like wild men, and horses without yang would be like the qiang. In other words, it is the presence and the renewal of the wild within the tame that makes the tame what it is and not wild. It is perhaps the same wild essence that enables humans to identify with wild animals and with men goddesses, allowing them to better incorporate within their human bodies either their flesh and blood through hunting or their fortunate essence through divination.